Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding. We also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we have Mr. Peter McGough. Peter was, of course, the editor-in-chief of Flex Magazine for many years. And after Joe Weider got out of the business, after Joe Weider retired, Peter went to work for Robert Kennedy for a little while for Muscle Mag International and then also Muscular Development. So he's been in the business a very long time, and he lives right out here in Florida. And I always like talking to Peter whenever I can. So we got a chance to catch up with him. And we just talked about a variety of different topics. We talked about who he thought was the best Mr. Olympia winners. So we had a discussion about that. And then we got into a pretty funny discussion about some of the Grand Prix events when Peter was covering the contest scene back in the early 90s. And we talk about what a great era that was because they had so many great bodybuilders like Flex Wheeler and Kevin Lavroni and Chris Cormier and Paul Dillette and, of course, Dorian Yates and all these great bodybuilders all turning pro at the same time. And these guys were winning pro shows right out of the gate. So we talk a little bit about that era when they were all coming into Flex offices out in Woodland Hills, Joe Weider's office, and they would do interviews with Peter every week. That was an interesting time, and Peter went on a couple of the Grand Prix tours that they used to hold after the Mr. Olympia, so he's got some funny stories about that. So we're going to talk to Peter in a second. Before we get to that, I do want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number out here in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's FL for Florida, alternativemeds.com. And even though they're in Tampa, they'll work with anybody in the continental United States. And if you tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, they'll give you a free consultation. They will also give you 20% off your first order. All right, on last week's show, we had Mr. Walter van de Breydon all the way from the Netherlands. And Walter was a judge with the IFBB from 1977 all the way up until 2009. So 30-year period where Walter was judging the shows. So we did get some comments about Walter's podcast interview last week. Lee Haney, great Lee Haney, said, "Please say hello to Walter for me, an awesome man." And Walter responded and said, "Thanks, Lee. I hope you and your family are okay." My friend Kevin Govan said, "Awesome. Keep it rolling, John Hansen." Jerry Branham said, "I'm listening." And Peter McGough said, "Walter is a great guy and a gentleman." James Lucas said, "I'm looking forward to listening." Brad Allen said, "What a great interview. I loved hearing a judge's perspective, and Walter certainly has a great memory. I think you were both discussing the idea of adding a posing or symmetry round to judging. I like that idea. For one thing, it would emphasize posing, which is basically non-existent now, and symmetry, which can be influenced by your choice of poses in a routine. Since they seem to be so against a strictly posing round, maybe a combo like this would sell some of the powers that be on it." That's not what we were really saying, Brad. We were just talking about how they used to judge the IFBB shows, and they would have the symmetry round first, followed by the muscularity round, the compulsory poses, and then they would have the posing round, which was judged. And now, of course, they just have one score. And actually, me and Peter are going to talk about this a little bit today on our interview, where they just have one score. They don't judge each round separately. So as Peter says, you'll hear this in the interview, they look at the symmetry round, they look at the muscularity round, and then they make their score, but they're really kind of judging the muscularity round. So if you have somebody who's got great symmetry, they're probably not going to be rewarded for that in the way the judging system is now. And Brad also said, and to add, this would incentivize bodybuilders to create routines that would stand the test of time. Nobody watches old YouTube videos of the mandatories in prejudging. The bodybuilder would have a future record of his talent for years, like so many old school bodybuilders now have on YouTube. That's why I think they should definitely start judging the posing round again. But we'll see. It would be great if they could bring that back and do it like they used to. All right. Also, we've got a couple emails sent to me. If you're interested in emailing me, the email address is naturalolympia@gmail.com. And I heard from our friend Mark Martinez. Mark was on the show about a year ago, and he is working on a documentary about the sport of bodybuilding. And it's about 1977 in California when Ken Sprague put together that parade that was down Santa Monica Boulevard. It was a real big hit. And that was right before the 1977 AAU Mr. America contest. So Mark is still working on that. He's shown me some clips. He sent me some clips by email. So it should be getting ready to be finished. And hopefully you can get it on Netflix or some other sharing service, some streaming service. So it'd be awesome to share that with everybody. But Mark made a comment about the Tom Terwilliger-Sean Ray interview we did a couple weeks ago. And he said, I enjoyed the Tom and Sean podcast. When Sean mentioned Bulldog Gym, it brought back memories. When I stopped working out at World's Gym in 1985 because I moved closer to the university I was attending, Cal Poly Pomona, I was looking for a gym that was a serious non-spa type of place. I found Bulldog Gym in Glendora, California, and I met the owners, Jerry and Tim Schneider. Jerry was a longtime policeman who took out a second mortgage on the family home to finance the dream of one of his sons, Tim. Tim had always jokingly said that he beat Sean Ray in a contest. Tim was a very good bodybuilder, and he trained incredibly hard. His love of the sport was and is old school. Tim mentioned him beating Sean in the team division of the Orange County Muscle Classic was an illustration of how great Sean would become. Sean, barely 17 and with little, if any, contest experience, had shown up more polished and prepared than many guys who had been competing for years, and only Tim and his few years of contest experience had eked out a slim margin of victory over Sean. Tim said everybody there that night had to know that they were witnessing the future star of the sport in a young Sean Ray. Keep up the good work, John. I also got a comment on our Apple podcast. So if you listen to our show on the Apple podcast iTunes, please go to that and go to our show, and you could rate our show and you could make a comment. We need better ratings. We've only got like a 4.5, I think, or 4.6. I was wondering why, because I saw everybody was giving us 5 stars, and I saw one guy about 2 years ago. He loved the show because he made a comment, but then he only gave us 2 stars for some reason. Maybe he didn't understand how it worked. So anyways, we need to bring that rating up. But Fluky70 from Great Britain wrote this on June 9th. He said, I love these podcasts. I started bodybuilding again at 49 years old after massive health issues last year when I was 8 stone and I'm 6 feet tall. I am now 12 stone and I'm making great gains. I used to be a massive bodybuilding fan as a teenager, so these podcasts bring back so many memories of the 1980s. All right. Thanks for listening, Fluky. And like I said, if you guys are listening on Apple iTunes, please go there and make a comment or rate our show. And if you want to have any comments or have any suggestions on the show, just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. I also added some videos on my YouTube channel this week. My YouTube channel is just under my name, John Hansen. So I put up Walter's interview that we did last week. I filmed that interview on the internet. So we have that video up also on my YouTube channel. So let me read some of the comments we got from that. Gabriel said, interesting. This is someone I met and spoke to a couple of times. Nice to see Walter again. The son of Krypton said, I love the interview, especially the photos of Walter and all the legends in days gone by. Angel Oliva said, excellent interview. Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Vert Real said, such a nice and humble person. Great conversation. Spritz said, everyone I hear says Reg Park was such a polite person. And he also said, in 1982, Chris Dickerson is wildly regarded as being in much worse condition than 1980 or 81. In reality, had it not been that last-minute judge who replaced a late Robert Nalon at the 1980 Mr. O, Chris Dickerson would have been the clear winner. It has been documented. Actually, he didn't replace Robert Nalon. Robert Nalon wasn't a judge. He was there at the show, but he was a photographer. We're talking about Peter McCarthy. Peter McCarthy used to run the Australian bodybuilding and he was replaced by Paul Graham, and they were going to have Peter McCarthy as a judge at that 1980 Mr. Olympia. And Paul Graham, if you remember, I said this in my interview with Dave Palumbo about a year ago when we were talking about the 1980 Olympia. Paul Graham told Peter McCarthy there was the judges' meeting was at this certain time. So Peter was going to get there about 15 minutes ahead of time to make sure he was there. And then someone came running into his room and said, hey, the judges' meeting was started about a half hour ago. So Paul Graham told Peter McCarthy the wrong time. So Peter McCarthy ran down to the judges' meeting, but it was too late and he was replaced. So he was able to judge the show. And if his scores would have counted, I think Chris Dickerson would have won the 1980 Olympia. But Peter's scores were not counted, and they used another guy named Brendan Ryan, who was not an official IFBB judge, but he was a friend of Paul Graham, and he was also a big fan of Arnold. And Brendan Ryan's scores did count. He was an official judge, and he gave Arnold, I think, a 20 on every round, just about a perfect score. And that was really helpful in helping Arnold to win the 1980 Olympia. So that was part of the controversy. I also put up the Jeff King interview. If you remember, I interviewed Jeff King last year. I think it was last fall. And I never had a chance to put it up on YouTube. So I finally worked on it this last week. And I added a lot of pictures of Jeff. It was just an audio interview. It wasn't a video interview. So I just added a bunch of pictures and I put it over the audio. And I also added some clips, some contest clips. So I got the clip of Jeff competing and winning that 1983 AAU Mr. America that he's famous for. I also got him competing in the 1983 NABBA Mr. Universe. And I even got a clip of the 1985 WABA Mr. World that Samir Banute won. And that was a great show because Jeff King got second. Eduardo Kowak was in it. Thierry Pastel was in it. Lance Dreyer was in it. We had some really, really great competitors. And this was in 1985. And I think this was probably the best Samir ever looked. He was fuller and a little thicker than he was in 1983 when he won the Olympia. But man, he was just in absolutely peak condition and he blew these guys away. So you remember Samir got sixth place at the 84 Olympia when he was defending his title. And he was so pissed off with the IFBB that he quit the IFBB for a couple of years. And this was the first show he did kind of in protest of the IFBB. He did the 1985 WABA Mr. World, and man, he looked fantastic. I wish he would have, when he made his comeback in the Olympia, I wish he would have looked like this. Or I wish he would have looked like this in 84 when he was trying to defend the title because he was off. Because I'm telling you, Samir just looked amazing. Big, bigger, and really hard. Just perfect. It was like perfect condition to show off all his symmetry. So check that out. That is on my YouTube channel under John Hansen. So when you get a chance. And I'm also going to put the interview we got up with Peter today. That will also be coming up on YouTube this week. All right. I also want to mention before we get to our interview with Peter, my summer fitness challenge. It starts the 15th, which is this week. So this is the John Hansen Summer Fitness Challenge. It's going to run from June 15th, this week, all the way up until Labor Day, which is September 7th. So it'll run the full gamut of the summer. And it is basically a 12-week transformation process where I will write up a training and a diet program for you, and I will check in with you each week. So I'll be your coach for the full 12 weeks. It's not like I'm just going to give you the program, then you're on your own. I check in with you each week. I see where you're at. If you're trying to get leaner, I want to see where your weight is at, what your waist is measuring. Make sure you're making progress each week of those 12 weeks. And if you're not making progress, then I will adjust something. I'll adjust your diet. I'll adjust your training program. I'll even write up different workouts for you each week. That's what I was doing last time we had the Summer Fitness Challenge. And if you remember, Paul A. Liotta won that. And I was doing that for Paul. I was writing him a different workout for him each week. And I was making it harder. So that's why he was able to keep the muscle and actually even build a little muscle as he was getting leaner. So that's very, very important. A lot of people don't do that. Some people actually train lighter and easier when they start dieting and trying to get leaner. And some people will use light weights and think that they're going to burn the cuts in, but it doesn't work like that. You still got to train the muscle really hard, and you have to diet at the same time to lose the fat. So it's a really difficult process, but I've done it a million times, so I know how to do it, and I will be there for you guys if you want to do it. So if you're interested in joining that, it's a great motivation for the summer. Go to johnhansenfitness.com, and it'll be right there, the Summer Fitness Challenge. Just click on that, join. And I will write you up a workout and diet program, and you'll be on your way. And just think about it. You'll be getting in better shape each week. So the summer is a great time to show off your physique. A lot of people, if they're not in shape by the start of summer, they just blow it off until the next year, and then they usually never get in shape that year either. So this is a great incentive for you guys to get in shape if you're trying to do that. And if you're not going to do it, and you know somebody that wants to do it, tell them about the John Hansen Summer Fitness Challenge, and they just go to johnhansenfitness.com and they could sign up. We've also got interviews on there with, like I said, Paul Aliota, who won. I did a YouTube interview with him. That's on my johnhansenfitness.com website as well. And I've got the stories of the top three guys. So the top three people who finish the Summer Fitness Challenge and who make the most progress, they are going to win prizes. They're going to get supplements from Old School Labs. They're also going to get copies of my books and copies of my DVDs. So that's just an extra incentive. But the real challenge, or the real prize really, is getting in great shape and looking awesome. And you're not too old, because our guy who got second place last year, Matt Craig, he is 61 years old and he got in great shape. I think he lost 5 inches off his waist in only 3 months. And he just sent me an email and he is now getting ready for a contest in October in Missouri where he lives. So he's going to compete again. So this really got him motivated to get in better shape than he actually was and to actually get back on stage. So good job for him. Oh, and one of the guys who entered the Summer Fitness Challenge, I don't think he'll mind if I mention his name, Mr. Charles Gaines, the guy who wrote the book Pumping Iron. Charles called me the other day and he said he got my email about the Summer Fitness Challenge, and I think he's now 76 years old. And he said he wants to put on more muscle. He said he's lost muscle as he's gotten older. He's not doing testosterone. So I'm going to help Charles out. I'm going to write him up a new training program. We're going to try and really activate those muscles and give him the right diet so he can grow muscle even in his 70s. So hopefully we'll make some great changes for Charles Gaines. I'm really going to be motivated to help him out because he's one of my idols, the guy who wrote the book Pumping Iron. All right, so that's it for our opening. Here is our interview with Peter McGuff, where we talk some old school bodybuilding. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And my special guest today is my good friend Peter McGuff. We're going to talk about some old school bodybuilding. Peter, how's it going?
Pretty good, John. Thanks for having me on here. I always enjoy the conversations, you know, going back into the history and sort of establishing how we got to where we are today. It's always, sometimes you learn a thing yourself talking about it, you know.
Yeah, it's always good. It's always good having you on, Peter. I appreciate every time you come on the show. I want to start off maybe talking about, you know, we're going on now the, I think this is the 55th year of the Mr. Olympia, because it started in 1965.
Yeah.
So we've seen the sport change a lot over the years, and you've been involved in the sport since the early 70s. I remember you telling me, you know, you used to go to the NABBA Mr. Universe when you were living in England as a young kid, and seeing all those classic competitions. So you got to see some of the great bodybuilders throughout the decades. I just did an interview last week with Walter van de Breyden, who is a judge from the Netherlands.
I know Walter.
You know Walter? Yeah, I figured you'd probably know. So Walter started judging competitions in 1977. He went all the way up until 2009. So he really got to see the gamut of how the sport changed. Yeah. So when we look at like all the Mr. Olympia winners from Larry Scott all the way up until Brandon Curry, if you had a look at all those guys, who are some of your favorites and why do you think they would be some of your favorites? Who do you think best represents Mr. Olympia?
Well, I think, you know, you have to come back to Arnold. I mean, he represented the Mr. Olympia, but also established it in many ways. Although it started in 1965, the NABBA Universe was still the main event up until 1971. I mean, Arnold won the NABBA Universe Pro Universe in 1970, won it three times. He would have probably entered in 71 again, but the IFBB brought a ruling out saying you couldn't go into another federation.
Right.
And although the 71 NABBA Universe was a vintage contest with Bill Pearl beating Sergio Oliva and Reg Park, the next year is when the Olympia took over, when Sergio went against Arnold and Franco and Frank Zadinessen. And after that, that became the main event, and the top bodybuilder in the world without a dispute at the time.
Yeah,
was Arnold. You know, there was a talk about, you know, he never faced off against Bill Pearl. Well, you know, Arnold told me once he was terribly disappointed about that 71 decision. He didn't say he wanted to compete against Bill Pearl. he said, because I wanted to beat Bill Pearl, because he wanted to show that he was the best around. And so he was a bit disappointed at never having had that matchup. But so back to the original question, I think he epitomises, you know, his dominance of the whole competition, certainly the, you know, the first 6 years that he won it, you know, it was everybody was there for second place, and he established the look that we all still admire today and quote as being maybe, you know, that's how bodybuilders should look. So Arnold would have to take pride of place there.
Yeah, I agree. Well, if you look also, I mean, Larry Scott won it twice and Sergio won it three times. And if you look at the number of competitors they faced, I mean, it was usually like no more than three competitors. And you're right, like in 72, it went up to like five competitors. And then you had guys like Serge Nubre, you had Frank Zane, you had Franco, and you had Sergio. So it really was an all-star lineup that year.
Yeah, it really took off then, you know. And, you know, Larry Scott, I mean, as the first Mr. Olympia, nobody can ever take that accolade away from him. You're the first, and that's the end of it. It's all over.
Yeah.
Of course, he won it twice, and he was quite honest about entering the third time. He said, Sergio came on the scene, and I knew it wasn't going to happen for a third time, which was refreshingly honest, really. You know, although he tried to come back later in the decade, it didn't work out. But yeah, I mean, as being the first, that's a golden moment for sort of the guy who was called the Golden Boy, you know.
Yeah.
Which again was, you know, a bit of marketing from Joe Weider's point of view. You know, Larry had dark hair. He got him to, you know, dye his hair blonde. He came from Idaho, but the inference was he was a California surf guy, you know.
Right.
That was all part, you know, selling that image that we all sort of fastened onto in the 70s. You know, I want to be the guy on the beach with the girl. You know, that was what was being sold. Build a body, get the girl.
Yeah. Know? Yeah, Dave Draper was like that too, right? He was another California. Yeah,
he's from New Jersey and then, right. You know, New Jersey. Yeah.
Now, looking at, I mean, Arnold definitely established a dominance over the competition, but when you look at Arnold's physique, even now today, probably 50 years later after he won the first Mr. Olympia, you still consider him one of the best? I mean, I know the sport's obviously grown and we have different standards now, but what do you think of his physique?
Well, I mean, all you can be is the best for your era. You know, you could say if you put Arnold in the lineup today, you know, he wouldn't place that high. You know, you could say that. There were certain Mr. Olympias who came and sort of pushed the sport forward. Sergio was probably the first one. Nobody's ever seen muscle like that, you know, and he created the standard. And then him and Arnold, you know, should have had a longer rivalry, but politics got in the way. Arnold established a certain look and was unbeatable for his era. Then Frank Zane, you know, created a new look, you know, the age of Zane, you know, this aesthetic conditioning that we'd never seen before. You know, Sammy Benu in his own way, although he only won one title, you know, really that physique he produced in 83 was really tremendous and sort of moved the sport forward a little bit. Lee Haney, his dominance, he moved the sport forward, created a new look. Same with Dorian Yates, who came afterwards, and Ronnie Coleman. So, you know, there's like, I don't know how many guys I picked there, but five or six who sort of just, I don't want to use the phrase, another Mr. Olympia, but they established a new benchmark for how Mr. Olympia should look. And, you know, here we are today with guys who are 4 inches, 5 inches smaller than Arnold, but outweigh him by 20, 30, 40 pounds.
Yeah, it was interesting when I talked to Walter last week. We were talking about how they used to have three distinct rounds with the judging. You know, the symmetry round, that's what they started with. So the guys would come out and do the quarter turns, and they would compare people, you know, call up three or four guys at a time just to do the comparisons. And then they would go to the muscularity round, and then they would do the posing round, and they would actually judge the posing round. So all three of those rounds were distinct, and they all created, you know, the winner. It was all important. And you wonder now how things have changed because the symmetry doesn't seem quite as important. You know, when I've said this before on my podcast, there's a picture of Arnold from, I think it was the 1973 Mr. Olympia, and he's standing, it was after he won the contest, he's standing on stage with his trophy. And I think Joe Weider's standing next to him. and he's just completely relaxed. His arms aren't out or anything. But to me, that guy, you know, that picture epitomizes what Mr. Olympia should look like. He had the muscle mass, had the shape, he had the aesthetics, he was definitely defined. He just looked like a Greek god. And if you look at Mr. Olympia as the most perfectly developed human being on the planet, to me, that was that picture of Arnold from 1973 really was it. And I think we've lost, I think, that aesthetic look where now it's, you know, when you got into Dorian, especially Ronnie, it was just who could be the biggest, most ripped guy on stage.
Yeah, I mean, the symmetry round, as you said, Walter detailed it. When they went, they still sort of had a symmetry comparison, but they then marked it as one score for symmetry and muscularity. So yeah. Symmetry sort of slid back a bit, you know, and the muscularity was the last one, the last round you saw. So maybe you tend to go with, you know, who looked the best in that round rather than remember, yeah, but that guy had great shape and balance and proportion and flow. That went, you know, in many ways, people blame Yates for the size explosion, but in many ways, Ronnie was the one that really, I mean, when he came out in 2003, after having had 2001, a close shave with Jay Cutler, 2002, Leveroni pushed him pretty close, and then he came out 287. I mean, it was just oodles and oodles of muscle that, no insult intended, but it wasn't put together in the sense of let's keep everything in proportion.
Right.
You know, it was like, let's see how much muscle we can put on this 5'11" frame.
Right.
And of course, you know, you couldn't sort of take the title away from him based on anything else but the fact that he just looked ridiculously awesome.
Yeah, that's the hard thing when it comes to modern day judging is how do you bring out symmetry when you got someone like Ronnie at 287? I mean, like you said, you have to give it to him, but it's sort of losing, you're losing the symmetry, you're losing the aesthetic appeal. You have to actually that big, right?
Yeah, I mean, Jay Cutler, you know, nearly beat Ronnie in 2001 with an aesthetic type of physique, symmetry, conditioning. Didn't do it in 2003. And then he took the size, you know, he went after Ronnie on size and eventually beat him in 2006, although Ronnie was slipping back a bit by that time. So, you know, it was interesting to think what would have happened if Jay had won in 2001. You know, it'd have probably stayed with that sort of look, and that would have been, you know, the benchmark. The champion's always the one that they zone in on. He's always the one that's called out first. Doesn't matter if he looks like a bag of lard when he turns up, not that that's happened. He'd still be the first one called out into the center as the defending champion.
Yeah. Well, going along those lines, what would happen if Sean Ray would have beat Dorian Yates in 94, and then you had a smaller, more aesthetic guy beating a bigger guy?
Yeah, I mean, once the guy wins the Olympia, I mean, it does mean something. I'm not saying, you know, they say he's got one hand still on the trophy. I don't go along with that, but you become the target, you know. If Sean had won, then people would have said, okay, how do you beat Sean? Well, certainly to beat Sean in the first case, you have to have supreme conditioning and then worry about the size. You know, you can afford, sorry about this, the bigger guys could afford to drop 10 or 15 pounds and take him on that condition factor, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, there are many, you know, what would have happened if this had happened or that would have happened, you know.
Yeah. So,
you know, if my uncle was a woman, it'd be my aunt, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's really amazing then when you look at the way bodybuilding is now, when you look at Frank Zane's career, you know, and how was he able to win? And he's coming after Sergio and after Arnold and after Franco. So it was really amazing that the judges rewarded his physique and they gave it to him three times.
Yeah, but he did create that look and he built up to it. You know, he came out in 77, real, you know, ripped to shreds look. And of course, his presentation was always awesome, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, what was it, 79 against Mensa. If you looked at them individually, you'd have thought, well, maybe Mensa's going to take this. But when he stood next to it, it was Zane's, you know, because of just the way you look, the balance, the showmanship and everything else.
Yeah.
You know, that all comes into it at that level. You know, Lee Haney was another great one for. He always looked better standing and posing next to somebody than standing on his own. You know, that's when he used to come to life.
Yeah.
You know? lots of instances of bodybuilders. Just some bodybuilders that don't come to life, and you're waiting for them to explode, and it never happens.
You know? Right. You know, it's interesting too when you look at Frank's career and you look at Lee Haney's win of the Olympia. I was looking back at old magazine articles. Frank Zane was actually 3 pounds lighter in 78 when he won it the second time. So he realized that in 77, as good as he looked to win it the first time, his reaction to that win was, I could be in better shape. He thought he was better shape in 76 when he took second to Franco. So for 78, he came in like 3 pounds lighter than he did in 77. So I thought that was really interesting. And Lee Haney did the same thing. Lee Haney from 84 to 85 came in like 3 or 4 pounds lighter because he realized his physique needed to be better. So I thought that was an interesting approach. I think nowadays guys would want to be 10 or 15 pounds heavier in a year than they were. They would be back down inside quality.
Yeah, I think, you know, once you get to the professional level, or at least it used to be the case that once you got a pro card, you know, you had a damn good physique. Yeah. And after that, it was a matter of refining, tinkering, maybe bringing up a lagging body part.
Yeah.
I mean, if a guy gets a pro card and he's got a lagging body part, you can bet your life he's not been ignoring that part for the last few years. It's just something just won't happen for him. You know, like Dennis Wolf, the calf problem. He tried every calf program you could think of, high reps, low reps, twice a week, every day, twice a day. Any combination, and those fibers just would not respond. They weren't there. The insertions weren't there.
Right.
So to get back to at the real top professional level, there shouldn't be an awful lot of body part improvement. It should be more a case of knitting it all together, bringing in a defined package.
Yeah, Lee Haney said after 84, when he won it the first time, he thought his thighs could have been more defined. So that was one of the. And then he also focused on trying to get his waist even tighter. So I thought that was refreshing reading Frank Zane and Lee Haney's approach to that. Even though they're Mr. Olympia for the first time, they don't want to get bigger. Their idea of getting better was to refine their physique and make it even more perfect.
Yeah, I mean, the first time I met Lee Haney was 1984. He did a guest spot in England, in Swindon. I'd seen him at the 83 Olympia, but not talked to him. And funnily enough, this was always my forte. When a guest star came to England, I used to track him down and get an interview and a photo session, you know. And there were other British magazines that were trying the same thing, but, you know, I was Sherlock Holmes and they were, you know, the local inspector, as it were. Anyway, I tracked Lee Haney down to his hotel room. I thought nothing in those days of knocking on somebody's door who'd never seen me before. You know, he opened the door and suddenly everything went black because he was so big. I had a photographer with me, Jeff Collins. I went in, said we want to do a photo shoot, an interview. He was okay with it. We arranged it for later on. And I said to Jeff, but you didn't take a shot. You didn't take a shot. He says, he was so bloody big. I just couldn't take my eyes off him, you know. But we did the photo shoot. That's the first time I met him. And he told me, now, this was April 84. And the Olympia was in October, I believe, in New York.
Yeah.
And he told me he would put at least, his arms would be an inch and a half bigger, which they were, you know.
Wow.
Because that was one of the weak points, you know. He didn't have a tremendous, and his waist would be tighter. And when he walked out in 84, it was over. In some ways, that was probably harder than he's ever been. You know, he was rock hard, his face was sunk.
Yeah,
it was a battle for second. There was no doubt.
Yeah,
he's won this, you know, and he, like most Mr. Olympias, you know, winning does something for you. Not just it does lead you to believe you can still make improvements, but it does something to the confidence level. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ronnie was never renowned for being outgoing and dominant and everything, but once he got the Olympia, his personality came out. He realized what he'd done. He had no inhibitions about, you know, talking about it. And that's not a criticism, by the way. Just something happens when you, I'm the best built man in the world. How can that be? I remember the night before the 92 Olympia in Helsinki, being with Dorian Yates. And in every contest he'd gone into, he'd been the underdog, you know, the little British scrapper coming in against the odds. Here he was, seen as the favourite, really, because he was runner-up to Lee Haney the previous year. Lee Haney had retired. And he was in doubt. He said, how can you be the best Bolt? What does it mean to, you know, the first time I've seen him question this type of thing. And then he suddenly says, well, somebody's got to be the best Bolt man in the world. Why not me? And that was the end of that conversation. Right. Yeah. So it does something to a guy when he takes the title, you know.
Yeah, you're right. I could really see that with Ronnie because he was so shocked. He had never made the top six before, right? In the Olympia before he won it. And then he went like I think seventh year before, ninth, and he got first.
Yeah, he went from ninth to first. Yeah. You know, you never saw Ronnie as a well, I actually did, but only at that last year. But do you remember 97 was a bit of a breakthrough for him? There were 7 Grand Prix contests after the Olympia.
Okay.
There were only 6 of them. And then Levroni gave Ronnie a couple of shots of vodka. And he won the 7th. He suddenly became vascular.
Right.
And then the following year, there was 3 shows, Night of the Champions, San Francisco, and somewhere else. I can't remember where it was. Ronnie won 2 of them. Kevin won 1. And in the Night of the Champions, I looked at Ronnie, back double biceps. And I thought, because Flex Wheeler was going to be the favorite because Dorian had been sidelined with injury, later announced his retirement.
Yeah.
Flex Wheeler was favorite. And we had him flex. We were doing a preview of the 4 guys, the 4 main guys. There was Nasser, Flex Wheeler, Levroni, and Sean Ray.
Right.
And at the last minute, I put Ronnie Coleman in, purely on the basis of what I actually wrote in the preview. He's the only guy in the lineup who can take on Flex Wheeler and in a back double biceps and hold his own, or even better, Flex Wheeler. So he suddenly came through in those matter of a year from just being an also-ran, you know, in previous Olympias. You know, when he won the World Championships in 91, nobody was saying, oh, here's a future Mr. Olympia.
No.
Nothing at all.
Yeah. Even though if you look at pictures of him back then, he did have the structure. He did have the shape. It just was a matter of getting bigger.
It was there. I remember Chris Thorne seeing him for the first time. That was in Poland, the World Championships.
Yeah.
And Chris said, I got to get that guy in the gym and get them biceps. You know, because even then, he had them great big baseball, was it baseball biceps and coconut delts or coconut dynamite?
You got it right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's wild. You know what? You just mentioned those Grand Prix that used to follow the Olympia, and that kind of did establish like who the next year's top guy would be, because I think Cutler did the same thing, right? In 2000, didn't he win the last one? And then the next year, he was like one of the top guys?
He'd been in the Olympia. His debut was, I don't know, 88, I think. Not 88. No. And he didn't finish in the top 12, top 10. And then the next year he was 8th or something. And
yeah.
And bang, he came through on the back of that 2000 show where he seemed to have at last got the formula right.
Right.
And then came and shredded at the Olympia. You know, the Grand Prix tours were much more formalized than there isn't a tour now. What used to happen was there'd be 5 or 6 contests after the Olympia. And weeks, months before, Wayne DeMille, who ran the tour, would get most of the guys to sign top guys. Mr. Olympia didn't always do it. From a top 10 in the Olympia, you'd probably get 7 or 8 guys doing it. So it was high quality.
Right.
And they all flew. They all had the same itinerary, you know, on the same plane. I mean, I went along on 2 or 3 of them, and it was exhausting. So I don't know how the bodybuilders got through it, because, you know, waiting to save money, no condemnation of him. You know, instead of, say, flying from Madrid direct to London, we'd go from Madrid to Zurich and to London. So it lengthened the day out. It increased the possibility of, you know, missing a flight, being a delay. So there was a lot of, you know, getting up at 3 in the morning to catch a plane at 6.
Oh, man.
You know, it really... It was almost like a badge of honor to get through it. And even though I wasn't a bodybuilder, you know, you bonded with them because we're all going the same thing. We're all meeting at 3 in the morning,
yeah.
You know, absolutely jet-lagged, you know, to get somewhere. And there was a sort of a camaraderie and a siege mentality about the whole thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was really confined to Europe as well. You know, the normal was England, Germany, Spain, France, Finland used to come into it, Switzerland a couple of times, you know, but there was usually five or six shows. Sometimes there was more than that. I remember one occasion, I think it was 97 or 98, there was a show on a Thursday night, a Friday night, and a Saturday night, you know, and it was like hopping from country to country, you know, and these guys used to sort of, you know, deliver, you know, they weren't showing up fat, you know. Every now and again, somebody would throw the towel in. I remember Ed Cowack, you know, wasn't doing very well, so we got to England, and he just about set the hotel on fire because he was having fried eggs in his room on a griddle. Fried eggs, you know. And he sort of come to terms with the fact that there's nothing I can do now to turn the clock back. You know?
Right. Yeah, I don't know how those bodybuilders did it. I mean, how do you train at all these different gyms, different countries, and stay on your diet? I mean, I competed once in Greece, and I was gone for like a week. And, man, it was tough just to try to eat right, you know, when you're in this foreign country. And try to – I was doing the same thing. I was cooking my food in my hotel room. It's almost impossible. I was like, I don't know how these guys did seven shows. That's crazy.
Well, 94 tour, we ended up – the first weekend, I think, was Spain – Germany, England, and then the next week, the first one was Italy. We got to Italy something like the Thursday for Saturday show, and it was a holiday weekend. The hotel staff were basically, there was no kitchen available, you know, there was no food available in the hotel. So Carlo Tiani, who was the promoter, who's a hell of a character, he went to the local supermarket and bought a van load of chicken and all sorts of stuff. And he was in the kitchen, you know, doing the meals for them, you know. It was, you know, like wartime or something. And the Italian crowds, you know, they have no, God love them, they have no respect for, you'd get to the hall and say Dillett had arrived, they'd all follow Dillett backstage. Suddenly he was in the dressing room surrounded by people. There was no control on them, you know. But Carlo tried to get them organized and that. And the only way he found he could get them to, you know, do as he said, he had to punch one of them, laid this guy out, you know. And after that, when Carlo said, get out of here. we got through the Italy show. It was in Milan, which is a hell of a city. And then the next leg, the next show was in Lyon in France, but we didn't fly. We got on a 9-hour train journey from Milan to Lyon through the Pyrenees. And it was an old fashioned train with compartments, you know, being on the Agatha Christie show or something.
Right.
You know? So everybody was sectioned off in the compartments. And the guy came along, there was a food trolley. It was the only food trolley, and it was basically sandwiches. Kevin Lover only bought all the sandwiches. So he had the trolley in his compartment, and guys were going in and saying, yeah, I'll have a cheese and ham. And he was like a crack dealer in Times Square, you know, doling out the, because there was no food.
Probably doubling the price.
I don't think the train stopped anywhere either. It went straight through to into Lyon, and then as these things happened, we got off at the wrong station. Then we had to get to properly, you know, and it was, you know, everybody was sort of in a goodish humor, you know. There wasn't anybody bitching about whether this is going on. I remember on that same, was it 91? 91, we had the Swiss Grand Prix, and we got to the hotel, and it was like a boarding house, and the promoter had got rooms assigned, but there was three to a room. There was a double bed and a single bed. You know, you can ask bodybuilders to share a double bed. I said to Sonny Schmidt and Milos, well, you two can share. You put a teddy bear in the middle, you know. But funnily enough, Thierry Pastel, who was on the tour, everybody used to wear baggies. You know, that was the age of the baggies and the floppy and whatever it is, and bean bags, whatever. Thierry used to travel in a pinstripe suit with a white shirt and a dark tie. You look like a financial wizard or something. And he stepped forward because it was French speaking, and he sorted out the rooms, and we all got the rooms we wanted, and there was nobody sharing. You know, Terry was a real gentleman. But they were wild, you know, those tours at the end of it. We should have had t-shirts made. I survived the Grand Prix Tour.
How long did they last, Peter? Was it like a week or 2 weeks?
Usually 2 weekends, you know, the 2 weekends following the Olympia. The very rarely was there less than 5 or 6 shows, you know. Yeah. Sometimes it spun into a third week, you know, but that was really stretching it then, you know. Because, yeah. It had to be a weekend. You couldn't hold a show on a Wednesday, although that year they did, as I've mentioned before, there was a show on a Thursday.
So if they had 7 shows and they were doing it over 2 weeks, they would do like a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, something like that?
Yeah. You know, like I say, you bonded with them. And, you know, there was that occasion in Spain, 94 Olympia, you know, Doran had that squeak with Sean Ray in the Olympia. He actually had contracted a bug and he wanted to pull out of the Grand Prix. He'd agreed to do the first 3 shows, which was Spain, Germany, England, and then not go the second week. You know, you could do that.
Yeah.
And I was flying from LA. I got to New York. Wayne D'Amelio's there. He said, I got a call from Dorian. He's sick. He can't do the show. And Sam Aranch is threatening to suspend him if he doesn't actually at least turn up and do a guest spot. Dorian agreed to go and then make his decision then. So I get to Spain. He arrives a bit later, calls me up to the room, and he says, okay, I can either do the show, take my chances, or do a guest spot, stripped off. What do you think? And I thought, no pressure, Dorian. You're telling me. I mean, if he'd have lost, it would have tarnished his Mr. Olympia credentials, right, you know. Right. And he was asking me. And I said, you know, isn't it better to take 10 grand for the first place than just do a guest spot? You're ready. You know, you can do it. Because although he'd had this bug and he dropped some weight, he dropped about 7 or 8 pounds. He was really shredded, you know.
Yeah, it looked better, yeah.
We went to the hall and I suddenly saw Kevin Leveroni and I thought, oh, Kevin looks a lot better than last week because he'd gone the other way. He'd gone up. And I was on the point of thinking, do I say to Dorian, let's not risk this one? And then they both sort of, they didn't pose against each other, but one was in one mirror, one was in another, and I was standing back, and I could see, no, Dorian's got it, he'll take this. Yeah. He was really sick all the way through. He hardly ate anything, he couldn't eat anything.
Wow.
I mean, the next night in Germany, Kevin was sort of behind him by only 2 points going into the evening round. They still did the posing round of the scored. Dorian knew it was close. And of course, everybody said his posing was just blasé. He went and he posed his arse off. You've never seen anything like it. You know, showmanship coming out of his ears.
Wow.
And he took that round. And that's probably the closest he ever officially came to losing a contest, you know.
Wow.
And then... Then on the Sunday, back in England, he just couldn't wait for that contest to be finished, straight in the car, home to Birmingham, you know.
Yeah,
he really was in a hell of a state. You know, he was still dropping weight all the way through.
Wow. So,
you know, they had the dramas. And, of course, you know, we had the Mohamed Benaziz in 92. He died after the Dutch Grand Prix, severe hydration.
Mm-hmm.
Dehydration brought on by diuretic use, you know. There were guys getting ill, not to that extent, you know, because the schedule was so tough, you know, to get the meals in correctly and trying to keep in shape and flights, you know, flying at 30,000 feet, water retention,
right,
all sorts of things. It was really a tour de force, but you used to get guys like Leveroni and Dillard and Cormier. They used to do it regularly. It was not like they did it once and then said, oh, never again, I'm not going through that again, you know.
Yeah.
They built up gained a lot of guest spots and stuff by seeing local promoters and you know, increasing the fan base, you know, because this was still relatively new, you know. We didn't have the internet or anything. Videos had only just started to come out, but if you wanted to see a top class bodybuilder, you had to go to a show. Otherwise you were just left with images in the magazine.
You
didn't see the statues move, as I always put it.
You know? Right. Yeah, we always have that discussion about how the old days with the magazines compared to today with social media. And one thing I wanted to ask you about, and we talked about this a little bit before, was when you first came over to work for Weider in California, and you said you had one, you went through this magical period of the sport where we had all these great new bodybuilders coming in the early 90s. We had Flex Wheeler, we had Kevin Lebroni, Sean Ray was already there, Lee Labrada was already there, you had Paul Dillette coming in, Vince Taylor. So all this great talent, Chris Cormier, and they were all competing. And you were the editor-in-chief at Flex at that time. So that had to really be a really great moment in the sport, huh? A really great period of time in the sport.
Yeah, because JoJo had signed most of those guys. You know, like I remember the 95 Olympia. I'm going to have to look at this. Of the top 10 guys, Joe, 9 of them were Weider athletes. You know, that was Yates, Lebroni, Nasser, Sean Ray, Vince Taylor, Chris Cormier, Mike Francois, Flex Wheeler, Charlie Clermont. Aaron Baker was the only one who wasn't a Weider athlete, and I that wasn't deliberate. I don't know why that was so. But for the first 5 years of me being a Weider from 92 to 97, I was basically a senior writer. I didn't take over the reins of editor-in-chief until 97.
Okay.
But because most of those guys used to live in Southern California, Venice and Santa Monica, they were always coming in the office, you know, regularly. You know, you'd want to do an interview with some of them and they'd say, well, I'll come up to the office, you know, killed an afternoon for them. So it was like central station for bodybuilders, you know, they were all coming in and leaving and doing interviews, coming in to see Joe. And even the outer towners like Porter Cottrell and Lebroni and Francois, you know, they never lived in California, but they'd be brought out for photo shoots and stay for 4 or 5 days and they'd come to the office. We'd go to the photo shoots.
Right.
So looking back, it was like a golden time of everybody just coming in and out of that building, you know, and the building itself was like a monument to bodybuilding with portraits of full physique portraits, more than life size of all the main bodybuilders, statues, the Sandow, every magazine that Joe had published, the cover was reproduced on the walls going down the different magazines.
Wow, really? Huh.
You know, it was, you walked in the door and you knew you were at the home of bodybuilding. You couldn't be anywhere else.
Yeah.
It always used to give me a buzz when somebody'd come for the first time and, you know, if you call up and say so-and-so was here, I'd go down and meet him and they were like, what the hell is it happened as soon as you walked in the door. There's a full-size, bigger size shot of Dorian, Arnold, and then there's a Sandow, you know, Frank Zane, Ricky Wayne, all these artifacts. And then Joe was also interested in the Remington Western statues and stuff. They were dotted all over the place, you know.
Yeah.
So it really was a museum feel to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And working in, you got to know the guys, you know, and some would have personal problems and you'd help them out. And I got along with all of the guys, really. You know, it was a golden time, and it's gone now. You know, that office is no longer there.
I know, I was going to say that.
Gold's Gym is no longer the hallowed ground. I used to go down to Gold's Gym every Friday, and basically I would get my gossip column because everybody was in there. You know, Mike Christian, Chris Cormier was in there. Sean Ray used to come up every now and again, although he was more in Orange County. Larry DeMay was in there, Mike Quinn, Gary Strider, you know, other guys used to train at Worlds like Lee Priest, Rolf Muller, Bob Paris, you know, they would be at Worlds. But you know, can you imagine that? You walk into the gym on a Friday morning at the right time,
yeah,
and there's 6 guys who were top 10 in the Olympia in different parts of the gym, you know. And at the time, you didn't realize how golden it was, you know.
Yeah.
You couldn't do that now. You know, round up 6 top guys and take you weeks to get them nailed down now. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I did an interview with Phil Williams, who won the Nationals in 85, and he was talking about when he was training at Gold's during the 80s, and he just said, we always thought it would be like this. You know, we never thought it would ever go away. We never thought it would change.
And, you know, like in 88, when the Olympia was in LA, and I went there for 10 days before, and, you know, all these top guys were in there. There was Lee Haney and Gaspari, and, you know, all the out-of-towners were already in. But then you'd see some guy and think, my God, he's got a hell of a physique. I've never seen him before. Who is it? You know, you go up and and it was Achim Albrecht, who was an amateur. He hadn't won the world championships then.
Yeah.
I said, so what's your next contest? This was 88. He said, 1990 world championships. That's the patience he had to wait till then.
Wow.
You know, Aaron Baker was in the gym and nobody really knew Aaron Baker then. It was before he was first. There was other guys in there. There was a guy in the, I know, I can't remember his name, and I don't know why. He had the biggest arms, quality arms I've ever seen. He didn't have an awful lot more, but he just disappeared from the scene. You know, we were going to do a shoot with him because it's like his arms are like, just told you, you know, this guy is, I mean, Arnold used to be, he'd be in Worlds, you know, he had his own parking spot.
Yeah.
I mean, now he's sort of seeing goals a lot, but in those, it was, you know, backing up Joe Gold, he would be in Worlds. You know, it was, you were guaranteed you could win any time and you'd pick some story up, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and then like you had all these great new pros coming up at the same time and all these guys were at the Olympia. And the thing that was so great about the magazines, I know you and I have discussed this before, was you could have the opportunity to do these long interviews with these guys and have, you know, a 4-page article about what about their personality. And then we got to know them a lot better. And then we weren't exposed to them on social media every day like we are now. So like you said, we had to wait for that contest to get here. And it really let us know the bodybuilders better, right? And you had guys from all different kinds of personalities, Flex, Lavoni. They were all different, distinct personality types.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be when a guy would come on the scene. You know, you think about guys coming on the scene. I mean, Yates was runner-up in his first Olympia in 91. The following year, Levroni in his first Olympia. Flex Wheeler, 93. You don't get that today. You don't get a guy winning a national title even qualifying for the bloody Olympics.
Right.
But anyway, so like Levroni comes on the scene, burst on the scene, you know, okay, you do your interview with him, you know, try and suss him out. Now, he was an individual character with quirky ways, amusing ways, and that was the way to paint him. Somebody who, you know, you'd start interviewing him and he'd end up interviewing you. So you brought that into his personality, you built it in. You weren't manufacturing anything, but you were building on his strengths. And because it was in the magazine and, you know, Kevin would then not be able to go on the internet and say something ridiculous to contradict everything we were doing.
Yeah, right.
You know, that became his persona, you know, Porter Cottrell, this really nice guy. People used to say, is he really that nice? Nobody can be that nice. I said, he's that nice. That is him, you know.
Right.
NASA with his, you know, well, what is wrong with people? Why are they all staring at me? You know, all these things he used to come out with, you know, and he divorced himself from the main bodybuilders and, you know, he was one alone. Flex Wheeler, you know, there was a guy, a bit temperamental, you know, in those days, totally different guy now. Mm-hmm. God bless him. And, you know, I remember interviewing him. I always know he was putting up a front. And he told me 2 or 3 years ago, he says, you used to sit looking at me and I'd tell you something and you wouldn't react. And it was like you were telling me, okay, now tell me what really happened. I'm not buying all the other bullshit, you know.
Right.
And we had a few laughs about it, you know. I mean, Flex was sometimes difficult to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And funnily enough, 3 or 4 years after he finished, he came to me and apologized for all the hard times, you know, in terms of not turning up the photo shoots or being late or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, he realized it was, and he was genuine. There was nothing for him to gain. He couldn't get a contract or anything. He just came to the realization. I mean, he is such a, you know, a change in his personality from,
yeah.
I think he was... He was shy, introvert in a way, and so he had to act as if he was an extrovert, and it didn't come naturally to him.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I agree.
And now he's sort of secure in his own being now, you know. It's funny how these guys all develop, you know, and you're talking about, you know, like Lee Haney just celebrated his 60th birthday, you know, and you remember him as a 23-year-old, you know, Gaspari. You know, the first time I met him, he admits it. He says, I was just a punk, you know.
Yeah.
He was a coffee, New Jersey, you know. He was, the first time I met him was I'd seen him in the Olympia. 85, he did a tour of England after the Olympia. He was third. in the Olympia. That was his first Olympia. He was third. Beckles was second. Haney was first.
Right.
Did a tour of England, and again I did my thing. I need to get him, you know, do a photo shoot. But he was not doing photo shoots, not doing interviews. Then he wanted a lift to this seminar place, so me and the photographer Jeff Collins gave him a lift. Jeff Collins is driving with, you know, with Gaspari in the front. And Jeff starts talking to him, you know, and so, you know, how do you get into this body? What sort of turns you on? And he's talking away, and he said, you know, one inspiration was some guy, I can't remember his name now, he was like 400 pounds, and he got down to 200 pounds to win the universe. I can't remember his name.
Oh, Bruce Randall.
And I said, Bruce Randall, you know. Oh. And he looked down as like, oh, and this has happened before. If you drop something in early to somebody, they realize, oh, he knows a little bit.
Right.
And he looked at me like, you're not as dumb as you look. And then he changed his mind, and we did the photo shoot and the interview. Because it wasn't just somebody who, you know, some freelancer from nowhere who was trying to get a story, you know.
Yeah. I did an interview with Gaspari a couple of years ago, and he told the same story, and he called him Tony Randall.
Yeah, he had a hell of a scene, didn't he? Jack Klugman beat him in the absinthe iceberg. I mean, I think back, you know, and it's like, I keep using the phrase, coming up, I've interviewed every Mr. Olympia apart from Sean Roden, you know, and I never got the chance to do that, you know, given the timing and everything, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a story with all of them. You know, Larry Scott, I interviewed him 95 about his Olympia experiences, and then now and again, we do like a round robin thing, you know, ask so and so five bodybuilders about this aspect, you know.
Yeah, I remember that.
I'm not sure we built up a relationship. I wasn't even sure that he knew who I was. But at the 2011 Masters in Florida, were you there?
No, I missed that, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, he was given a Lifetime Achievement Award, and the night before we had a press conference, and they announced that Larry would get the Lifetime Achievement Award. Asked him to say a few words. Now, this is one of the biggest shocks I've ever had. He stood up. He says, before I start, I'd like to give thanks to a guy who's done so much for bodybuilding. And he looked across at me, and I thought, he's not talking about me because he doesn't know me, you know. He says, there's an English guy who came here and really did great things, wrote great things, and I'd just like to walk across and shake his hand. And he did that. He shook my hand, and I was speechless.
Wow.
And some guy said to me afterwards, but you never responded, you know, apart from that. I says, I couldn't. I was too emotional. Larry Scott comes up to you and tells you, you know, is this a dream? He used to come into the office maybe twice a year, even though he lived in Utah, because he used to advertise in the magazine. So he'd come in with new artwork or whatever. So he'd say hello, but I never realized he even knew who I was, you know. But that was one of the, looking back, you know, it was certainly one of the most surprising moments, one of the most grateful moments that somebody, I mean, he's a legend, you know.
Yeah,
obviously.
Yeah.
First Mr. Olympia.
Larry just seemed like just such a genuinely nice guy. Even when I remember when I was a kid and I used to read Muscle Builder, and he had the Ask Larry column in the back. And you could just tell by the way he answered a question. He was like, he seemed like really concerned and wanted to help everybody that wrote a question to him. He just seemed like such a nice person.
I remember the first time Sean Pareen, you know, the late Sean Pareen.
Yeah.
Introduced himself to Larry. It was Olympia Expo, and he contacted Larry because Sean was put in charge of collecting all the Mr. Olympias that were at that contest and get them on stage.
Okay.
It wasn't the big one when everybody was there. This was a few of them missing.
Right.
And he says, I always remember because I was there with Sean, and Larry says, and your name is, and Sean said, Sean Pareen. And Larry said, what's a lovely name. I don't know why he said it, but you know that was
yeah.
You know, it sort of stuck in my memory that he had that.
It's a shame that the younger people today don't remember the impact Larry had, because I interviewed Roy Callender, and Roy was one the 79 Canada Cup or something like Diamond Cup. And that was the last time he made his comeback in.
Yeah.
When he was talking about that, he said Larry was in the show. And I said, oh, I forgot about that. And Roy said, I didn't forget about it. He said, that was like one of the greatest moments of my life. And he goes, I went up to him backstage and I told him what an honor it was to be on stage with him. Because Roy remembered the impact Larry made back in the 60s, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. When I got into looking at magazines in the 60s, this was even before Arnold and all those guys came in. You know, the real stars were Larry Scott, Reg Park, Dave Draper, Freddie Ortiz. You know, I don't know why it is. I can't explain it. But because I was part of the sport when the other guys started to come through, I had no inhibitions about talking to Franco or Zane or, you know. But I was always in awe of Larry and Dave Draper and Reg Park. I never met Freddie Ortiz. I met the other three. And I remember Dave Draper came into the office and then somebody came down to my office and said, Dave's outside, you know, I'd like to see you. And I thought, Dave Draper. I did tell his wife, Laurie, I don't know why it is Reg Park, Dave, you know, Larry. They were still these images, these long ago images in the magazine, like gods, you know, whereas the other guys, I've seen them come through. So they didn't suddenly hit me as, wow, what's that? You know, the first time you saw Scott, he was complete, you know.
Yeah. They must be the ones we grow up idolizing when we're kids and we never lose that idolization, right?
Yeah. It was, and, you know, Larry had that personality that carried everything off, you know. A very straightforward, down-to-earth guy. I mean, most of them were. There's very, you know, I mean, I'm often asked, who are the biggest arseholes of a man bodybuilding? And I have to think, you know, I mean, other people have got their own views, but, you know, there's not many of them that have been, you quantify that way. And the next question now is, who are they?
Well, when you say that, I remember, like I said, I was reading Larry's column in the back of Muscle Builder, and Vince Gironda used to always have a column. I think it was in Muscle Mag. And he would just rip people apart every quick. What kind of stupid question is that? You know, what kind of idiot are you to ask that? This guy, you can tell his personality right away.
Well, Mike Manser was like that in his writing, wasn't he? You know,
yeah, he was.
If you don't believe this, then you are an imbecile.
Right.
And the thing was, when you spoke to him, he wasn't as hectoring as that. You know, he was more open-minded. But with him, it was like, I've said it now, you've got to go along with it. There's no argument.
Yeah.
Of course, he had that sort of very Corinthian type of voice, you know, very, it was theatrical. He wasn't put on, but he had a very distinctive, sharp way of talking, you know.
Right.
Of course, not a very good impersonation, but it was something like that, you know. And he had a vast vocabulary, you know.
Give
you tremendous phrases.
Were you in the audience at that 80 Olympia? Were you involved in it then?
No, I wasn't. I was following bodybuilding, but I wasn't reporting on it then. No.
Yeah. I can't believe we're coming up on 40 years since that contest.
I know. I mean, just to give you an indication of the time, I mean, we were waiting for the Olympia results.
Yeah.
And the magazines didn't come out till, you know, 6 or 8 weeks later. I'm going down the local news agent in the, well, not the local. There was a news agent in Nottingham, England, who did the bodybuilding magazine. So you duck your head in there. Mm-hmm. It was near the gym. See if the latest Muscle Builder Power was in it. It hadn't yet become Muscle Fitness.
Right.
And there's the latest issue on the shelf, and it's got a montage of Arnold. And I'm thinking, what the hell is the Olympia? What's the Arnold doing? It took me some, you know, I had to open it. Arnold won the Olympia. We didn't even know he was entering it. You know?
Yeah.
But that's how, can you imagine that today?
No.
You know, it's, things move so fast. I always think, you know, Big Ramy, he came through in 2013 at the Night of the Champions. He walked out, everybody went nuts, bananas, never seen anybody that big, you know. It was a sensation. It was all over the internet. By Wednesday, it was a dead story.
Yeah.
If it had been back in the old days, people might have heard something wonderful happened. And you'd have to wait for the magazine another 6 or 8 weeks. But right. 6 to 8 weeks after that, it was a done deal. And, of course, people think well, we've seen him, we know what he's all about. He would have been presented in the magazine, you know, built on his personality. You would have got to know him a little bit better than just a fusillade of shots. So, you know, those days are, you know, seem to have gone. I mean, you know, criticism of the younger generation in general, you know, bodybuilding, non-bodybuilding, tend to want short, sharp reads on the internet. You know, give them a 3,000-word story and maybe, you know, they run out of stamina. Or the writing is crap and it's not very interesting.
Right. Yeah, I remember in that 1980 Olympia, I was in the gym and some guy comes in and he goes, "Did you hear what happened?" And we go, "What?" He goes, "Arnold won the Olympia. He came back." And we're like, "Really?" And he's like, "He blew him away. It wasn't even close." So we're all excited. And then it took, like you said, it took 8 weeks for it to come out in Muscle and Fitness. And it was only like a half-page story. And there was like little pictures of everybody. And then I think the little article said that it was kind of controversial. And then we had to wait another month. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, it was like we were talking about it all year because then the story was slowly unfolding. You know, articles like Jack Neary and Rick Wayne and whoever else wrote about it. And it was such a different time. Like, you're right now. Like, now, you not only get the results right away, you see the show live, and then it's over by Monday. By Monday, it's like, well, who's going to win next year?
Yeah. And you think, you know, you follow the play-by-plays, and, you know, which are well done for the most part. And then the after interviews, you don't learn a lot with interviewing a guy when he's just won. He can't even take it in. The time to do it is the next morning and then do an article on him. But that's gone now. So you tend to think, oh, that's how so-and-so responded to winning this contest. I know the whole story now. Well, it's like, I mean, my job was to, as a writer, I used to try and take the fans into places that they couldn't get to. You know, I wouldn't discuss who had the best back double biceps. They could make their own mind up based on the photographs. But who was in a bad mood? Who was in a good mood? Who was joking? Who was doing this? Who was really? Who was being sick? You know, who was, you know, the whole thing, and build a story, a narrative. You know, not just a succession of, you know, paragraphs, but get a theme running through it, and knit it into a, you know, a flowing story with a beginning, middle, and an end. I think if today, see what used to happen, you'd. This was even pre-top laptops and everything. So Saturday night, the Olympia would take place. You'd dash around getting some interviews afterwards with guys. You know, you'd hold him there. I'm coming. You know, you had to get organized because they were all trying to rush off, especially.
Yeah, they didn't do very well.
So you'd end up with all your notes from the day, the pre-judging, all the quotes afterwards. There was no internet, so at least you'd go out and have a meal after it was all over. You get on the plane Sunday, you try and do something handwritten. Then what I used to do is I'd stay at home Monday. I'd write the whole report, stay up usually Monday night, go in Tuesday morning, give them the report, and then they would start work on it. The photographs would probably arrive late Tuesday or Wednesday, and it was filmed. There was no digital.
Right.
So I had to write a report totally based on what I saw and remembered. Later on, you could have a look at the digital. Oh, well, maybe biceps weren't that good, you know. But you were committed to write it that way. And that's how it all used to come together, you know. It would take days to do it. But I still wonder if somebody, say the next Olympia or even the last Olympia or every Olympia, if somebody said, "We'd like to come out with a report, you know, on the Wednesday, the real story behind the Olympia," and do it in that way. Because I'd do the main report, then there'd be two or three other guys who'd be following, or get Labrada's take on this, get so-and-so, they do a sidebar, you know, on what.
Yeah.
And if something happened, you'd get the whole Olympia package, you know, the whole story from start to finish in one stop. I just wonder whether people, I'm sure some people would still have the stamina to go through that on a Wednesday and find out they'd learnt an awful lot of things that they didn't learn on the Saturday, Sunday, Monday.
Right. Well, you were there at a time when you were really like a newspaper reporter. You were like an investigative reporter, right?
Yeah. Funnily enough, nowhere was that better exemplified than when Sally McNeil murdered Ray McNeil, her husband, in 1995. It was St. Valentine's Day. So I got into the office, I think it was a Tuesday, suddenly heard about, because things didn't spread then. I think Steve Venestrom told me, because he was in San Diego where they were, you know, Oceanside. And Julian Schmidt sat behind me. John Little sat somewhere else. I said, I need your phones. You two are going to have to find somewhere else to work. Because I got a direct line through to the DA, because he wants a lot of information on Ray. I gave him his bio and his move, you know. The local paper, I got onto them. I gave them photographs so they could show Ray. They gave me information. And I came out with a scoop of actually what went on. And, of course, it was still 6 weeks before anybody read it, you know. And I was really on the job, you know. Felt like it was a Jimmy Olsen, you know, cub reporter, you know. Fast forward to 2005, leaving home on Friday. It was the Craig Titus and Kelly Ryan case. They were on the lam then. I'd connected with the district attorney. He phoned me like, I was just about ready to leave work from Vegas, you know. He phoned me from Vegas and said, we're about to pick him up in Boston. We tracked him down to a hairstylist or something like that. And she got him. So he tipped me off and it's 6:30 on a Friday. And now I've got, you know, the cub reporter had disappeared. Now it was like, do I really have to go through all
that? Right.
Obviously we did it. Because then it was no sort of, well, this can wait till Monday. I had to be out there that night because we had the exclusive to tip everybody off what was happening, you know.
Right, right.
I sort of, you know, the gossip column I did, Hard Times, I used to pour everything into it, you know. Very competitive, you know, in terms of having not just get the scoop, but putting a spin on it and adding some humor to it and connecting it with something else. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to collect all this information over the month. And then like 2 or 3 days before the deadline, I would go home with all this information and put the column together. No, that's not worthy. This needs to be added, you know. And I used to pick all the photographs and everything, so it was like a little newspaper, you know, of its own. It was like a mini pumping press, because, which is the tabloid we used to do, because we used to have headlines on the first page of the gossip column. What Samia said next, so-and-so in fist fight, you know, whatever. You know,
right.
Sharon Bruno as you've never seen him before, whatever. You know,
right.
It was like the headlines, you know.
All right, Peter. Yeah, I want to thank you again for joining us on the show. It's always great talking old school bodybuilding with you. I always learn something new every time you're on. And
that's because I always make it up. I mean, even I haven't heard some of the stories I've said tonight, but never mind.
I hope you're doing good, and say hi to your wife, Ann, for me. And the next time you guys are in Tampa, I definitely want to see you so I can take you out to dinner. So okay. Promise me the next time you're here, you'll tell me.
I'll be up this afternoon. Yeah. Okay, John, thanks again. It's always a pleasure to reminisce about, you know, what we've both committed ourselves to. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. All right, Peter, thank you very much. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. Thanks to our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring the show. Thank you also to all our Patreon donors who are sponsoring the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast by making a donation each month. I really appreciate you guys. And if there's anybody out there that wants to help support the show, just go to the website, bodybuildinglegendshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner is our Patreon link. And just click on that. And you can donate as little as $5 a month if you wish. So we appreciate all our Patreon donors. They're really helping us out. Be sure to check out my John Hansen Fitness website if you're interested in the Summer Fitness Challenge. I've also got a lot of other training and diet programs on there. So be sure to check that out. And as I said, check out my YouTube page under my name, John Hansen. Got a lot of great new videos up there. So we will see you guys next week on the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. Take care, everybody.